This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are going to start today in Washington, where pressure is on senators to deliver both the cornerstones of President Biden's domestic agenda. So that's a bipartisan infrastructure bill and a massive social spending plan. The Democratic Party, which holds slim majorities in the Senate and in the House, set a Halloween deadline to get them done. From roads to taxes, child care, much hangs in the balance here. A few minutes ago, we asked this question to Senator Elizabeth Warren. Will the party bring its promises home to Massachusetts by its own deadline?
I sure hope so. That's what we're working on. Because, look, we're reaching a point. We just need to fish or cut bait here. You know, we're all pretty much saying the same things to each other. And now's the time that's hard. You know, everybody's got to give a little.
Is cut bait on the table, Senator?
You know, I use that in the metaphoric sense. There are going to be some cuts, though. We're not going to get everything we wanted. Nobody is. And that's me, and that's true for the other 49 Democrats who are trying to hash this out. What I care about is that the Republicans, who will not help us at all and not vote for any part of this and will not participate in the discussion, I don't want what they want, which is nothing. They want nothing to happen. And that's, we're not going to do that. We're going to get something, and we're going to get it through, and we've got to get it done now.
So what might get left on the cutting room floor that will be a disappointment to you, and what will probably survive that's really important to you?
Well, I have to say it's looking hard around community colleges right now, and that's tough. That hurts a lot. On the other hand, it's looking really strong around child care and universal pre-K and getting a really robust program, a strong program that will help families that are just really struggling with the cost or struggling because they don't even have any available. So trying to make it so that every family that needs it has got access to affordable, high-quality child care. God, that would be transformative, transformative for millions of women, particularly across this country. And by the way, raise the wages of every child care worker and preschool teacher in America. That's pretty exciting. So, look, I want everything, but I'm really happy about the child care part as it now stands.
Senator, you are being so transparent with me on this, and I really appreciate it. So I want to stay with that for a minute, and I want to ask you kind of what's in my heart on this. Congress holds a lot of power. This is a party right now, a Democratic Party, that holds the House, the Senate, and the presidency. There's work to be done for the country. How should voters in Massachusetts feel when, with all that power, things are still so uncertain? Can the work of the country get done?
Well, it's true. Democrats hold the majority in the House, the Senate, and the White House. But our majority in the Senate hangs by a thread. We are a 50-50 Senate. We hold a majority solely because the vice president is also a Democrat and can break a tie. And that means that, I just say this in the abstract, any Democrat who says no threatens to upset everything we've got here. We have no margin for someone walking away. And that means there's more compromise going on than certainly I had hoped would be the case. But here's the part that gives me hope. We all know how much this package is needed, how the pieces in it are so important, child care, home and community-based care, expanded health care. We're talking about vision, dental, and hearing for seniors under expanded Medicare, and how it is long past time to put a real investment in fighting back against climate change. We know how important all of this is, and knowing how important it is, we cannot fail. We cannot let ourselves fail. So I know it looks messy from the outside right now. Heck, it looks messy from the inside right now. But I think we are moving forward, and I have real hope that we're going to get this done, and we're going to get it done pretty soon now.
In what you hope passes, what is most important for your constituents here in Massachusetts? What do you think is most essential to bring to the Commonwealth?
I think childcare is very high on that list. We are one of the most expensive states in terms of the cost of childcare. And keep in mind, when people can't work, that has echoes all the way through the economy. So every time I talk to a retailer, a small business, a restaurant who says, I can't get employees, even though I'm offering more money than I used to, part of the problem, I will ask right away, do you have workers who have childcare problems, or did you have workers? And they say, yes, can't get people back in the door. And that then continues to echo through the economy. So for me, that's one of them that I think is top of the list in Massachusetts. Also, I think it matters enormously in Massachusetts that we try to build some fairness back into the system. And that is to ask billionaires, giant corporations, they've got to quit this business of paying nothing or nearly nothing in taxes. I'm not even talking about raising the marginal rate. I'm talking about the folks who get away with paying nothing. And let's be clear, many of them do it legally. I think that is really bad for our Commonwealth and bad for our country. It undermines confidence in the notion that we're a democracy and we're in this together. And when hardworking middle-class families have to pick up the full ticket and billionaires, Jeff Bezos, is paying less in income taxes than the typical Boston public school teacher, that's just wrong, and people know it's wrong. We need to demonstrate that we've had enough of that and that we can actually fix it.
All right, I know you have a heart out, so let's take just a minute here to talk about the reintroduction of the Stop Wall Street Looting Act. You've just been talking about billionaires. This is about private equity and preventing them from saddling the companies they invest in with debt in order to get payouts. But I had to do reading, right, to get to that understanding. Could you just briefly explain for our listeners, what are you trying to do and what's the focus of that bill?
Right. So think of it this way. You have a nursing home that is a nice little outfit, mom and pop, been running it for a long time. The kids took over when they retired. And some private equity outfit in New York figures out, wait a minute, I think there's money to be made here. So they come in. They offer the current owners a nice price for it. And then instead of investing in the business, maybe adding another wing or stepping up, redecorating the game room, they say, what we're going to do is suck all the value out. So they actually sell the building and pay themselves for what they just bought, and they don't put any money in fixing it up. Then they saddle that nursing home now with rental payments when it didn't have any rental payments before. They cut staffing. They cut supplies. And we end up in a world, and this is what the numbers show, where when private equity takes over a nursing home, costs go up by about 10% and deaths go up by about 10%.
So I'm sure you know that the American Investment Council, which is, you know, the trade and lobbying group for the industry, has told CNBC that the industry directly supports more than 300,000 jobs and invests in 545 companies just in the Commonwealth. Is there anything good that private equity is doing that you want to hold on to as you stop what you think is harmful?
So let me just push a little bit back on the statistic they quote. What they're really talking about is private equity now controls nursing homes in Massachusetts, mobile home communities in Massachusetts, for-profit colleges in Massachusetts, and that's how many employees are currently working at those places. In fact, what we know is once private equity comes in, they lay people off and they reduce salaries. So you know, I get it. They are the lobbyists, so they're going to spin it the best way they can. But this is a real problem for us in Massachusetts. Now, I don't want to cut out all private equity. Private equity wants to come in and invest in a business. Private equity wants to come in and help expand it, help build it up, help it do better. Shoot, I'm all for that. What I'm opposed to is private equity that comes in and sucks all the value out of a business with a giant vacuum cleaner, pays itself, and then leaves a hollow shell that either just limps along with fewer employees and less investment, or ultimately collapses into bankruptcy. I just want to put some curbs on the industry so that's not what happens.
Do you have time for one fun question before we let
sure.
you go? Halloween yeah. in a week and a half, will you be home to
yes.
celebrate in your neighborhood? And what's the candy of choice in the Warren household?
So, yes, I'm going to be home. I am actually looking for my candy. I love Mounds, particularly.
Me too.
You know, the
yes.
candy bars. But I went to the store last weekend, and they didn't have any. So I got a bunch of other candies. But if I can find it, I'm going to be handing out Mounds bars. And I should say, our dog, Bailey, he has his costume.
Oh, what's he going to be?
He's going to be a lion.
Fantastic. All right. Well, that is my moment of joy for today. Senator Warren, Massachusetts Senator, thank you so much for joining us. Happy Halloween.
You bet. Thank you. And happy Halloween to you, too.
Should the state keep the Lawrence schools under receivership? Or after 10 years, should the city get back full control of its school system? That is the question the city and the state are grappling with after violence at Lawrence High School, a series of fights on and off the campus since the school year began that injured some students and faculty. This Monday, over 100 people, including teachers, parents, community leaders, rallied outside the school saying that this, quote, crisis didn't happen overnight, end quote. They want more resources, more attention to student needs, and a change in leadership. The same day, Lawrence's school committee voted to ask the state education commissioner to end its 10-year receivership of the district. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a member of the Lawrence School Committee. But first, let's turn to WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Max, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How did we get here, Max, to a school committee Monday night saying, hey, give us back control after a spate of violence in the high school?
Yeah, I don't want to draw too tight a connection between the two phenomena. I think that this feeling of exhaustion with the receivership was growing long before these fights sort of materialized. But I do think that receivership, as we'll discuss, you know, can be an exhausting, discouraging process on its own. And after a difficult time in that community, hit hard by COVID, hit hard by the economic consequences of it, you know, you could get a sense that the crisis is coming to a head and people are asking questions.
So a bit of a tipping point after a long slog. So explain what receivership is then. What is that long slog, Max?
Yeah, it's basically, it's the biggest disruption that a school district can experience, right? Sort of the last recourse of a state when academic performance is persistently low. So basically, no more strongly worded letters, no more alarming labels. The state appoints a receiver, it can be a person or a nonprofit group, that has sort of the combined powers of the superintendent and the school committee. So they have practically total control over budgeting, staffing, curriculum, you name it. And I think it's based on this sort of Obama era idea that school districts will sometimes need an external jolt to turn around when their problems become so sort of enormous or systemic that they can't actually deal with them directly at the local level.
So that's the general explanation. Is that a pretty fair description of how Lawrence wound up with its schools in receivership, or is there something special or distinctive in that case, Max?
Well, it was the first after this practice was passed into law in 2010, as I recall. It was sort of a textbook case. You had persistently among the lowest test scores in the state, bottom five districts, and then a graduation rate that was hovering around 50% for 4 years from high school. But I think there was also a reasonable sense of serious organizational dysfunction in the city. You had just months into the receivership, the prior superintendent pleaded guilty to embezzling district funds. The city's then mayor, Willie Lantigua, and some of his staff were also under investigation. And so, you know, the state had a plausible case to say, you know, we need to go with receivership. They appoint Jeff Riley. They pass it in 2011 and appoint Riley 2011-2012.
So you talked about exhaustion. Lawrence was hit hard by the pandemic. Then there was the 2018 gas explosion. Earlier this week, we spoke with Kimberly Berry. She's the president of the Lawrence Teachers Union. She's been teaching for 26 years. She's a literacy specialist at Partham Middle School. She says the fights, as you said, are a result of a school system that doesn't properly support the students. That was her emphasis. There's not enough staff, especially counselors, to meet their needs.
We know that our students come into the schoolhouse with a lot of needs, and without being in person in school over the past couple of years, there's been a lot of trauma. And we know our kids need support in health and wellness, in social, emotional learning.
So that trauma seems to be center here, Max, the social, emotional learning. And I do want to note, you know, students, faculty, staff from the school staged a walk-in about this on Monday morning, which is serious activism. Is that activism surprising?
I don't think it is, Tiziana. I mean, you have, first of all, in Lawrence, the natural kind of spur or occasion of a 10-year anniversary. It's a long time for things to be so abnormal. Then you have Riley, who was their former receiver, now the commissioner who oversees and evaluates their receiver. So there's a personal history there. And then think about the last year and a half we've had. You know, you've got three Massachusetts districts in receivership: Lawrence, 93% Latino, 79% low income; Holyoke and Southbridge, who have sort of comparable numbers. So all of them were hit hard by the virus. All of them are low income, low prestige, low political power communities. And after social justice, equity-minded protests nationwide, can you blame them for saying, hey, the state isn't taking over white districts, wealthy districts? What's going on here and when does this end?
So, Max, I'm going to ask you to stay tuned. We are going to bring in a voice from Lawrence, and then we'll come back to you. But before we do, I just want to say we reached out to the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education to be on the show. They declined, but they did send a statement just before the show, and it said in part, "Student safety and support are paramount for both the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education and Lawrence Public School leadership. The department will continue to support Lawrence school officials to ensure students have what they need to be successful this year." So, Max, we'll come back to you. I want to turn now to Joshua Alba, Lawrence School Committee member. Joshua, thank you for joining us on Radio Boston.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thank you for covering this subject that we've been trying to talk about for a long time.
So, Joshua, I don't know if you had time to hear me talk with Max, but he talked about kind of the tipping point after a long fatigue. This is a decades-long receivership. Does it feel like something has tipped to you?
Absolutely. The fact that on Monday night at the meeting that the mayor, Candice Vasquez, called with the school committee and the city council, we heard time and time and again from parents, from educators, from a few students, how tired they are about the mismanagement, about lack of adequate resources and wraparound services. And that it's not, people don't want to blame COVID. They're saying that the problems have been existing since before COVID, and COVID just exacerbated it.
So one of the things that's on my mind, Joshua, I mean, is in covering this and in hearing the comments from parents, teachers, school committee members, there's this concern about insufficient support for the kids. I'm also mindful that when there are incidents of violence at or near a school, it creates trauma for the young people in the school. Right. Do you feel like Lawrence High School students are getting the support they need right now, right, while this back and forth plays out?
No, the superintendent has put out a safety plan where they are blocking out the first couple of periods, the first block of classes, to have some conversations in the classrooms. And added some SROs, some school resource officers and police officers, and are getting together a stakeholder group to figure out what kinds of programs and initiatives we need in the Lawrence High School. But no, I don't think it's adequate enough. In an era of a global pandemic that has disproportionately impacted our community, to the tune of around 230 something dead and a couple thousand infected. And we reopened our schools and forced our kids back to double down on learning to make up for learning losses. And the staff shortages that we have around crisis counseling, around school psychologists, around counselors, it's frustrating to even talk about it right now, to be honest. These kids need to be focused on their social emotional well-being. Our community has been really rocked.
I can hear your frustration there. And I want to ask you, so Monday night, school committee vote, putting forth a petition to the State Commissioner of Education to end the receivership. All but one committee member supports that vote. So what happens now? Do you feel like that has teeth with the state? Are you satisfied with the response? We read the statement, you know, just before you came on that we got. Are you satisfied with the response?
Definitely not. I think the story of the receivership for the last decade has been one of great acclaim across the country, especially Massachusetts. There's been a lot of research written on Lawrence being the model of a turnaround, your other guest kind of explained. And the community coming at this boiling point to say that's basically not been, at the very least, it hasn't been the whole story. And I would go as far as saying that it's a lie. Lawrence is not a model. And I think we have to really take a step back and look at the racial and the class dynamics that are at play here, where rich, wealthy white folks from Boston are telling a poor minority Black and brown community how to run their schools. And that's really, really problematic. I'm Dominican American myself, first generation. And for electeds and for our community not to be involved in the decision-making process in such a foundational institution such as our schools, there's a great injustice happening here.
Let's talk about the superintendent, too. The superintendent is Cynthia Paris. We reached out to Paris's office. They shared a list of action items released last week. We invited them to come on the show. They shared these action items. A few examples: scheduled changes to reduce crowding during lunch and dismissal, a new positive school climate task force, a restorative justice center for students serving in-house suspension and for kids who need additional mental and emotional support. That's a piece of the list. Have you spoken? Has the committee spoken with the superintendent? And how is that back and forth going?
Right now, there's a meeting happening. Well, tonight, rather, there's going to be a meeting happening that I hope to attend regarding that, like, stakeholder group to see what we could do in the schools. I'm also convening a group of nonprofits that used to be in the district that service at-risk youth. Street workers that are from the community, that are formerly incarcerated people, that know how to handle these situations. And I think that the conversations between the school committee and the superintendent over the past year has been very little. She has not come to our meetings when we've called them and invited them to come through. And so having this conversation now, as you could imagine, is tense, to say the least. I haven't talked to her myself personally regarding this issue. My intentions are to do what I can, talking with the teachers and the students and the parents myself directly, and convening forums that I can control, that I could make sure that their voices are really being heard. Because the concern is that we heard on Monday night and that we've been hearing for the last, I've been doing this work since 2016, education justice work in the community, that in these stakeholder groups, as she likes to call them, and PTOs with the administration, that parents don't feel like they're really being listened to, that their input is not really being integrated, and that they're essentially being used as rubber stamps to say, hey, look, we did community outreach. All right, bye. And it's here we are where there was a massive fight of like 50 something students the other day, and kids got pepper sprayed, and the police are provoking the students as well in this situation. Like, I'm really afraid of the solutions being proposed are going to end up making our schools into more of a police state than they already are.
So Joshua,
that's not conducive to our public safety.
We've spoken with some parents, for example, Lauren's parent, Marianella Rivera, yesterday, who served on the school committee. We're hearing these concerns echoed, right, other places. And I think just in my last question to you, what can you do? I am so struck by your frustration, by what I'm hearing both in your words and in your voice. What can you do, and what do you do now? What do you do tomorrow, given these circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, everything that we've tried to do has been met with the roadblock that we are under state receivership and we do not have a seat at the table. There's no way for us to hold the district accountable, the superintendent accountable. There's no way for us to see where the money of our tax dollars and your tax dollars are going, because we receive a lot of funding from the state. We don't have a line item budget. And so therefore, when we've been holding these forums with parents and teachers and students throughout the years, talking about all the changes that we want to do, even if we get some changes in a local school over here in one district and another district, there's no way to ensure those programs continue because we don't have a seat at the table officially.
All right. That is Joshua Alba, Lawrence School Committee member. Joshua, we appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I do want to note again, we did reach out to the superintendent's office. We also reached out to the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. We've given you pieces of the statements. Neither was available to appear on the show today. However, still with us, WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. And Max, I just want to give you a second to react to what you just heard.
Well, I think that keyword exhaustion surfaces again for me, Tiziana, and you remarked on it. There is this sense. I mean, it's hugely discouraging to not be able to run your own school district when every other community but two or three can do that. And it feels like this black cloud. I read a recent sort of ethnography on receivership in Holyoke, similar in some ways demographically to Lawrence. What people spoke to was a sense of tension between the sanctioning role of the state, as in you're not doing a very good job, you need to turn it around, tighten it up, and the supportive role, meaning you can get better. And I think at this point, it's the sanctioning kind of scolding face of the state that's being seen and complained about in Lawrence. And I think that makes some sense, again, after a decade and a very hard year to cap it off.
So my last question to you, Max, I feel like one of the things I learned from you in talking to you today is how new this concept actually is in the Commonwealth. And so I wonder, have we seen a path out? Has any school district come out of receivership? Do we even know how that works or what it looks like?
No, we haven't. Lawrence was the first district placed in receivership, and they're still in it. Holyoke and Southbridge were added later, and so are they. And without making an unfair analogy here, to cast no aspersions on these districts, there was, when the war in Iraq was beginning, there was the Pottery Barn rule. You break it, you own it. What it leads to is staying a very long time, maybe much longer than you would have anticipated. And I think something similar might apply here. Now the state is responsible for a turnaround. And if they don't feel like they've gotten it, how do they dismount? How do they leave? It is very hard to imagine the handoff after the year we've just had.
Well, WBUR education reporter Max Larkin, I've learned a lot. Thank you. You've given us a lot to think about. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
These days, heroines can be easy to spot on the silver screen, from those with superhuman powers like Captain Marvel.
I'm kind of done with you telling me what I can't do.
To more subtle incarnations like Mother Marmee March, advising her daughter Jo in Little Women.
You remind me of myself.
But you're never angry.
I'm angry nearly every day of my life.
You are?
impatient by nature. But with nearly 40 years of effort, I'm learning to not let it get the better of me.
Okay, not going to lie. I absolutely love that scene. Actress Brie Larson and Captain Marvel first, and then right there, Laura Dern and Saoirse Ronan in Little Women, both from 2019. But for the women of myth, for fairy tales, the path to heroism was not so clear. And that's what we're going to talk about. That and how we got here. How do we recast those ancient stories? What is a mythical woman hero? That's what we're going to talk about, and we're inviting you to join that conversation. Have you tracked that journey? What is a mythical woman hero for you? Have you read the old myths and wanted someone to tell that story or interpret it differently? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Maria Tatar joins us now to have this conversation. She is the author of The Heroine with 1001 Faces, and she is also the chair of the program in folklore and mythology at Harvard University. Maria, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So I have to tell you, I this was not my planned first question to you, but I'm so curious. What did you think of those two pieces of sound? Does that reflect some place we're getting in our stories about who women are and how they are heroes?
Well, as I listened to Marty, all I could think of was Mildred Hayes. Do you remember Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri?
Frances McDormand.
Yes, absolutely. And how she uses words. She has some weapons too. And she's a woman who understands the power of violence. So she's a little unusual in that way. But the fact that she is an angry woman, she is bent on revenge. But we could also think of her as being bent on social justice, on some kind of justice for her daughter. So we have now emerging, Hollywood is giving us these new models of heroines. And on the one hand, we have the warrior woman who is kind of imitating the heroes of ancient times, seeking glory, seeking immortality through conquest and combat. But there's another model that I think harks back to the heroines of ancient times, women who use words and stories and craft to find a way to secure justice, to bend the arc of the moral universe, as it were, toward justice.
Tell us about one of those women. Give us an example from old mythology or fairy tales.
Oh, well, one of my favorite is, we could start with Philomela and then maybe talk about Scheherazade as well. Philomela is raped by, she's the victim of a sexual assault. She's raped by her brother-in-law, Tereus. And what does she do? She threatens him. She tells him that she's going to broadcast the story of what he has done to her. He responds by cutting out her tongue. And Ovid, in the Metamorphoses, Ovid, who tells us this story, describes in great detail, in excruciating detail, the tongue that is quivering on the ground. So Philomela no longer has words, but what does she do? She weaves the story of her rape into a tapestry and gives it to her sister so that the deed will come to light. Now, we could also think about the Me Too movement in this context, where stories are used to get even, in a sense, but also to change the culture in which we live today. And that's where I think Scheherazade is so important, because she is a courageous woman. She volunteers to marry Shahryar, who is killing off one wife after another the morning after. And what is her strategy? What is her weapon? She uses stories as her sword, in a way. And she tells these cliffhangers, which are so seductive and so exciting, that Shahryar decides to let her live for another night. And this continues for 1,001 nights. And then she not only survives, she saves her own neck, but she also changes the culture in which she lives, because Shahryar then decides to end his cruel, violent ways and take a different turn in his role as ruler.
So I want to say two things here. First, for our listeners, in order to have this conversation, we're going to keep hearing stories like this. It is part of what is remarkable about the myth and the fairy tale. So be aware, we are talking about sexual assault. We are talking about violence. We are talking about the muting of women and repression, and that will continue to be a part of this segment. The other thing that I want to pick up here, Maria Tatar, and then I'll go to our first call. You really struck me. You told those stories, and then at some moment in the book, you talk about the Little Mermaid and her losing her voice in order to essentially come to the surface. And that just slapped me in the face, this tradition of then muting women if they want to get what they – not even get what they – I'm never going to try to finish the sentence because you can finish it for me.
Silencing, yes, because those stories were so powerful, because they were weapons – we needed strategies to silence women. And so you can go back to the Odyssey and hear Telemachus telling his mother to be quiet and go back to her weaving, or figures like Philomela, whose tongue is cut out, or the Little Mermaid, who trades her voice. And what does she trade her voice for? But the love of a man. You know, she really wants a soul more than anything else. So in some ways, she uses the prince also. But think about how women's talk has also been trivialized. That is, we think, who are the gossips? How are they gendered? We always think of them as women. And we think of gossip as something that is cruel rather than a possible strategy for finding solidarity among like-minded folks. Or we refer to chit-chat or chatter. All of that, all of those ways of not just silencing women, but discrediting what they have to say. The most spectacular example, of course, being Cassandra, who is able to foretell what is going to happen in the Trojan War, but nobody pays any attention to her at all because Apollo, who gave her the gift of prophecy, decided to take it back by telling her that that nothing that she said would be believed. And why does he take it back? Because she decides, she has misgivings about having an affair with him.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, just thud, right? Thud right there, that story. It so underscores your point. 800-423-8255. Courtney's on the line in Cambridge. Courtney, join the conversation.
Hi, thank you so much. I was, I guess it never stuns me how synchronous sometimes the radio can be, especially your show. My friends rewrote the myth of Medusa and showed it in the Museum of Science last year. Projecting it onto the planetarium, Brian King and Nathan Cohen and Dennis Monagle, they all played the music for it. And then Brian King really wrote the script, I guess. I don't want to, you know. But it is about Medusa, who was raped by Poseidon, and portrays the gods discussing, you know, how to put Athena in her place, because Athena had really overstepped her power and her boundaries. So the way they were going to put her into her place was to rape one of her goddesses. And so Poseidon went down and did his thing, and then the rewrite is about how Medusa wasn't a monster, but that Athena sent her to be at peace, because she really did want to be somewhat of like a, not a recluse, but just at peace. She didn't want to be involved in the human drama of victim, villain, rescuer, the social drama triangle. And so she was given the mask of Medusa to protect the land and the magic that
Courtney,
she could see.
That's such a great example. Thank you. And Courtney's example there, Maria, it's this perfect segue into one of the brain benders of the book, which is, you know, we think about, we often talk about, well, women don't get written as the heroes. But part of the point that you're making in the book about these stories is it's not that they're not written as the heroes. It's that we don't recognize what they've done as heroic. And that's something a little different. And that is very powerful. And that reframing that Courtney was just giving us about Medusa, I feel like kind of underscores that point.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And if you think about it, in the 1980s, women writers like Anne Sexton, Angela Carter, Margaret Atwood, Toni Morrison took up folklore and fairy tales. And what do? They retold the stories from a different perspective. And suddenly they sort of turned them inside out and upside down. Now, in recent years, what has happened is that women writers have taken up Greek myths. They've taken up the story of the Trojan War. They've taken up the epics and told the stories from a different perspective.
Like Circe.
So you have Pat Barker, who writes The Silence of the Girls, who gives us the Trojan War from the perspective of Briseis. And suddenly we see Achilles is actually a butcher. He's a monster. He fails miserably as a hero, but Briseis has this quiet dignity. She cares for other people. She's curious about their welfare, and she manages to become heroic in that narrative. And then in many of the other works, like Natalie Haynes' A Thousand Ships, or we could think of Ursula Le Guin's Lavinia would be another great example.
So I want to now pick up on another thread, and I want to bring in Game of Thrones, if you'll forgive me. And it's because at the beginning you also talked about there is this other version where we are making the women the warriors. And in reading your book, I kept thinking about Game of Thrones. Spoiler alert, folks out there, if you haven't watched the series or read the books. Women are treated abominably. Then they wind up with power and control, and then largely they pay for claiming the warrior's place. And that is recent yes. popular culture.
Yes, fascinating, isn't it? And you have a whole range of figures in Game of Thrones. Now, you know, the men aren't much better, I would say,
that
particular series. So, but that's fascinating because I talked about some of the new models for heroism that are available. And I would say not just for women, but also for men. But then we have the anti-heroine who is emerging in films like Get Out, where Rose becomes a kind of Bluebeard figure from fairy tales who's killing off, or like Shahryar, who's killing off successive fiancés, or Ex Machina, where you have a robot who is, I guess, should I put in a spoiler alert?
Yeah, we're spoiling things all over the place, folks, yes. So just
well,
go with
let's
it.
Let's put it this way. We have another anti-hero, a woman who is really to be feared, and something very different from those heroines who exercise curiosity and care in order to survive and to help others survive.
Oh, please stay with curiosity for a minute, because that was another big theme.
Oh, yes. Think of our foundational stories. Eve. Eve is seduced by the serpent. She eats fruit from the tree of knowledge. And yet we always see her as somebody who is interested in carnal knowledge. She seduces Adam, and she brings evil and sin into the world, much like Pandora, who lifts the lid of the jar given to her, and then releases plague, famine, want, labor, all of these terrible things into the world, leaving us with nothing but hope. So curiosity, this a virtue in my book, and something that we want to promote in children today, as we raise children, want to promote it in ourselves, is something that is demonized, is seen as a negative trait when women possess it or exercise it. And etymologically, curiosity is actually related to care. Early usages of the term, if you go back to the 16th, 17th century, you discover that curiosity means being attentive, caring for something. And that's so, it's such a no-brainer in a way. It's totally logical, because when you are curious, you begin to care about something. And I think that the beauty of the story of heroines is that they use that. And in the 20th century, 21st century, they become detectives. They become writers. They're trying to navigate their way to a better world.
Harriet the Spy, Nancy Drew, both examples.
Yes, absolutely.
So I want to turn now to helping people think about what to do with what you're framing up. So I have an older sister who's coming this weekend. She's part of a book club where they don't read books. They read either articles or chapters. And I would love to give them the first chapter of this book. What is the discussion question for a group of women who want to dive into this together? What if you were in that room, what would you tell them to talk about, or questions would you tell them to ask?
Oh, I think the first question would be, what is a hero and what is a heroine? That is, how have you thought about that over time? And how have we framed heroism way back when up to the present? And you start to realize that the concept of heroism isn't stable at all, that it changes over time. It evolves. Who were our heroes during the past 2 years? Healthcare workers, the people who were taking care of us, and then the scientists who were curious and trying to find a cure for us. And that constellation of traits, I think, is just so powerful. And it reminds us that the model we have today is very different from what we had even a few centuries ago, but certainly completely different from what you find in ancient times.
So I won't have time to go to Susan in Arlington, but she wanted to point out Maleficent, the most recent versions of that, which take her from a bad guy, her backstory, to someone who is trying to defend the nature and the people around her. So we have about 60 seconds, two or three stories, maybe one from a fairy tale, one from mythology, one from a movie that people should check out, just sort of rapid fire.
Oh, start with Bluebeard, my favorite tale, which is about a husband who is a serial murderer, and his wife is a curious woman who wants to find out what is in his forbidden chamber. So she opens up the door, and if you read it, you'll find out what's in that chamber. And then I suppose for an update of that, let me invoke again Get Out, because it's a rewrite of that fairy tale. And then I think what I would recommend is Pat Barker's The Women of Troy.
Fantastic.
I have just started, and it's breathtaking.
Maria Tatar, chair of the program in folklore and mythology at Harvard University and author of the new book, The Heroine with 1001 Faces. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to talk to you.
That is our show, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow. We'll do Radio Boston's Week in Review.